dead.
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
We want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded.
On Fridays from 1 till 2 p.m., prepare to get your jeans dirty. Join me, Bobby the Badger Ferris, for the greasier side of rock and roll, rhythm and blues, and country. From Hank to the helicopters, from Otis to the Oblivions, it's the perfect way to slither into your weekend.
We won't talk about the habits. Just the music and the man.
That's the Barn Burner every Friday from 1 till 2 p.m. only on CITR 101.9.
Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR.
Chrissy behind, it's fine all of the time. Like sex on the beaches. What else is in the teachers of peaches? Huh, what? Sucking on my titties like you wanted me. Calling me all the time, that Bondi. Check out my Chrissy behind, it's fine all of the time. What else is in the teachers of peaches? Like sex on the beaches.
Fuck the pain away. Fuck the pain away. Fuck
pain away. Fuck the 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 pain away. Peaches, peaches, sex on the beaches. What? Right on. Fuck the pain away. 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 Fuck the pain away.
Welcome to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you might be one of our podcast listeners if you're listening to this after the fact. Because sometimes, or maybe you're just listening to it a second time because you like it. Anyway, welcome to the show. It is Caroline McGillivray, and I'm really excited, actually, because it is almost Valentine's Day, which, since we're doing a sex and romance show, it's really good to think about all the things that we're really severely grateful for all the time. And in every moment of our life, it's really important, but especially at this time of year when there is the V-Day initiative, which, for those of you guys who do not know, V-Day is a global movement to stop violence against women and girls, and V-Day is a catalyst that promotes creative events to create awareness, raise money, and revitalize the spirit of existing anti-violence organizations. And it generates broader attention to stop the fight against violence against women and girls, including rape, incest, battery, female genital mutilation, and sexual slavery. And it's pretty exciting. There's going to be a performance here at UBC. They've actually done a couple of them, actually, of the vagina monologues and a memory, a monologue, a rant, and a prayer. And that is actually going on campus at UBC and all around the world on campuses and independent people doing it, where the money's raised goes to raise awareness and to raise funds for anti-violence groups within their own communities. So it's pretty exciting. The UBC production is actually raising money for the Sexual Assault Center on campus, as well as that it's also raising money for Wish Drop-In Center's Mobile Access Project, which is in the downtown east side. And it's a really wonderful project that does work with some of the most vulnerable women in the city. But it's pretty exciting. I love the fact it does so much good stuff. Usually whenever there is a production of the Vagina Monologues, we honor people who do really good works for people. So, and that goes all around the world, whether it be Africa and the Middle East, Asia. It just focusing on honoring people and really encouraging them and supporting them to do the work that they do. So my guest tonight is a very special guest that I've been wanting to book on the show for a very long time. So I'm very excited to finally have him on the show. And in my book, even though I'm not doing a production of the Vagina Monologues, just producing a show talking about the work that is being done and all the great things that how far along we've come and where we need to go in terms of violence against women and especially survival sex workers, because especially in Vancouver, our Vancouver's downtown east side, there's a lot going on, and in light of the Olympics and everything else going on, there's a lot of things that would be done. And with Valentine's Day coming up, there's the Women's Memorial March as well, so we're going to touch on that too. But my very special guest is Dave Dixon, who is a dear, dear friend of mine, who also sits on the board of Beauty Night Society, so I'm very, very lucky to have him. He's born and raised in Vancouver, and he joined the VPD in May of 1980 and ended up becoming an advocate for street workers and youth, and he spent his entire career working in the downtown east side, and over the last 6 years has received a number of awards. And in my mind, Dave, you are a vagina warrior, even though you've achieved a lot of different awards over the years. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. That's very nice.
Well, I think you've done such great things for the women. It just blows me away.
Well, it's really easy to sort of do stuff for them, because I got hooked in years ago, and I just sort of, I have a lot of empathy for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they sort of get the short end of the stick from everybody.
They really do. I'm really glad. I know earlier today, before this interview, you and I chatted a little bit about Pamela Massick's display about the missing women that the exhibit's on right now over on West 2nd Street. And just in terms of just with the case and everything. And we were talking a little bit about the art. And I'm hoping that that raises more awareness. And I just wanted to say, if you've got any, if you'd like to share any thoughts about the exhibit.
Well, I hope it does, you know, raise a lot of awareness, because I found it absolutely amazing what she's done, and I sort of thanked her for it, but just it didn't seem to be adequate, because I really couldn't believe what she'd done, you know, for the 4 years of her life that she put into it, and she, without having met the women, managed to capture them. It was really emotional, because through that whole investigation, I sort of, other than being, you know, involved in the sort of starting it, you know, I didn't go out to the farm, I didn't go to the trial, I stayed away from, for, you know, personal reasons, because it was so emotional. But when I went to see the portraits that she'd done, it was, you know, it was a bit overwhelming, you know, but it was incredible, really, you know, quite moving.
Yeah, I found it really moving as well, and again, very emotional. And what I liked, though, is it got people talking again. And I think that's so important.
Well, that's always a good thing. And like I say, Pamela's just done an unbelievable job on the portraits. Because I think I told her she'd moved into another, you know, whole stratosphere, you know, in terms of art.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very impressive. Yeah.
No, she's done some really good stuff. She's a vagina warrior in my books too.
Yeah.
But you've been a vagina warrior for a very, very, very long time. So, how did you get involved? And I know we've talked about it before, but just for our listeners out there, in a nutshell, in terms of working in the downtown East Side, and in specific, more focused on the women, because as you got to know them.
Well, I guess it was just I sort of fell into it. I think partly because of, you know, the way I was raised. And when I started with the police in 1980, it wasn't quite what I expected, and I sort of witnessed firsthand that, you know, the horrible conditions that they had to live under, and I think that's where I, you know, just the compassion, you know, part, you know, I just started sort of doing what I could, and extended a helping hand, and gave them my card. My pager was always on pretty much 7 days a week.
24/7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if they needed sometimes just advice or to talk to somebody, and because they have a very difficult time reporting things sometimes because of their occupation, because of the time frame, you know, and a whole bunch of things. And even sometimes the police relationship was never, you know, that great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I always tried to sort of overcome that and you know, take that extra step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just evolved from there, like the first couple of years I was on the job.
How do you think, in comparison to 1980 to present day, how has it changed? And has it changed for good, better, or a bit of both?
I can't see it better.
Okay.
I mean, the women are still, and that's really sad when you think it's just about 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm still, even though I left the police, you know, a little over a year ago, I'm still working down there for another organization, so I'm still heavily involved in trying to look after the kids and the street kids and the women.
Mm-hmm.
And the women are still subjected to, you know, just as much violence as they were before, and sometimes more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the money down there is, you know, so overwhelming with the illicit drug trade. You've got a number of organized gangs down there that are all vying for the same, you know, sort of, you know, piece of the pie, and the women get stuck in the middle. I mean, you've got women getting their hair cut off and getting beaten for $40 drug debts.
Wow.
And in the old days, when in the 80s, at least there was some respect, if somebody was beating on a, you know, a female, some of the street dealers would have jumped in and seriously hurt him. But that just doesn't happen anymore.
Why do you think that is? Why is that change?
The crack cocaine was probably the biggest single change to the downtown East Side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the crack is so addictive and so destroying. You know, everybody's just looking for their next little rock cocaine, so it's, you know, it's just horrible what it's done down there.
Have you found, I know when I'm down there volunteering sometimes with, at the very beginning, I'd say in probably 2000, I noticed a huge difference from now till then, where I could usually tell if somebody's on heroin or if they're on crack, and now I can't tell, sometimes just with meth.
No, you've got such a different, you know, sort of mindset down there, and most of it, you know, is smoking the rock with the little pipes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably 75% of the drug use is rock cocaine. You know, and it makes them more aggressive, it makes them more addictive, and it's, with cocaine, you may use it, you know, 10, 15, 20 times a day. With heroin, it's maybe 5-6 times a day. With the rock cocaine, it's literally continuous. As soon as you finish, you're looking for your next rock.
Wow.
And that goes 24 hours a day until you crash.
Wow.
You know, and that's, you know, that's what I mean. It's just made, it's changed the whole, you know, downtown East Side.
Mm-hmm.
And not just downtown East Side. I mean, it's now spread out because of SkyTrain. You know, now you've got pockets everywhere through the Lower Mainland.
Do you think there should be more resources in general? Because I remember maybe about 5 years ago when there was a transit strike, Judy McGuire, who used to be with Dais, she had mentioned that she noticed a huge difference in the amount of people that were in the downtown east side, like where it was a lot quieter before they made the SkyTrain a mandatory service. And she said it was a lot quieter, where sometimes she felt that some of them were coming from other areas, and perhaps if there were other service providers, that we might be able to deal with things a little bit better.
Well, certainly if there was more treatment, I mean, that's still the one thing we're lacking. There's still not one place. If a male or female came into my office tomorrow and asked for help, you know, with a detox bed or treatment, there's not one place in B.C. that I can drive them to.
Wow.
And I think that's appalling after all these years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the experts tell you, you have to have treatment on demand, and we still don't have it. And that, you know, at a cost of like countless, probably hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
You know, being spent over the last 25 years.
And at the same time, it's just like, where, you know, what does it cost to keep somebody who is dealing with addiction? Like, it'd be nice to see what those stats are.
Yeah. No, I know, because if they're in the addiction, they're in a constant sort of lifestyle of crime and a whole bunch of other things to support that addiction.
So it's...
property crime, you know.
It costs our society a lot more, in other words.
Yeah, it does. And so sometimes I really question it. Like, if somebody at the top, I would think, would have to sit up and take notice and say, wait a second here, let's take a time out. Yeah, but they don't seem to, you know, to do that.
What do you think the answers are? A couple months ago, you did a piece, which it was a really cool piece that appeared in the Province newspaper about cutting off the supply of kids. And if you would speak to that a little bit in terms of about how young kids are when you sometimes see them on the streets.
Well, the downtown side, if I see a child standing in, you know, when I say child, maybe a 12-year-old or 13-year-old, you know, young female standing in the corner of Main and Hastings, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning, like I did this particular, and this one is 14, though, you know, the one I wrote about.
Wow.
I already know that it's almost already too late because the damage is already done.
Mm-hmm.
So with our lack of resources, I know it's you know, it's going to be an overwhelming task to try and get that kid back on track, you know, because there's just no place we can send them. I mean, and when we phone the ministry, our after-hours services, the response is less than, you know, warming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this particular instance, I phoned and the person said that they would put a note in for the day shift worker. Well, this is 5 o'clock in the morning, and they're prepared to leave her down there, you know, surrounded by predators.
Which is heartbreaking.
Well, it is, because I told them I'll do it myself, and I did. You know, I removed her from the downtown side, because this is another kid that just gets hooked in. She was actually waiting for probably one of the worst predators down there. You know, but that, so they just don't get it. And this is what, and like I say, when she's 14, you know, it's already almost, you know, impossible to help her. So we have to catch these kids when they're, you know, basically just coming into the school system.
So what do you think the answer is in terms of in the school system? What should teachers be educated in so they can start looking for those clues, and parents as well?
Well, I think they have to be able to recognize children that are coming to school. If they're not fed properly, if they're not clothed, if they're not being looked after and meeting their basic needs, I would think that, you know, they're good enough at what they do to recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really when you have to get the resources and fix it then.
Okay.
And if you could cut off the supply then, we wouldn't be seeing this. And there wouldn't be missing women and a whole bunch of other stuff.
That is true. At one point, there was the kiddie stroll down on Franklin Street. Do you see that still, or has that disappeared inside more?
It's you know, it's disappeared up Kingsway and and inside, too, because, they, you know, the kid, and some of them are run by organized gangs. They know that if they stand them out there, that they're going to get grabbed by the police or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they have disappeared for some part, but they're still visible up Kingsway.
I was absolutely shocked when you told me that sometimes you can find kids as young as 6 or 7. Is that still true?
It is, but you don't find them, you know, like what happens is sometimes you'll go into a home and in the past, you know, the youngest I found out in the street and then alley in the backseat of a car was 10.
Wow.
But I've had other instances where I've gone into families and the information was there, but not enough to do anything about it.
Hmm.
You know, that the young kids were being used for that.
Wow.
And that's a hard one to wrap your mind around, but you really have to understand where the family's coming from. The family's been abused, you know, the mother in particular, for so long. You know, it's a generational thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when I first started on the job, I really blamed that. I thought, how could any parent do that? But when you find out the background of the parent, you know, they just had such a horrendous life that they really didn't know any difference.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a learned behavior, as hard as that is to believe.
No, it makes sense because we all eventually sometimes, I shouldn't say we all, but we do turn into our parents sometimes. I catch myself doing that all the time. It's like, oh my gosh,
sure.
I sound like my mother.
Yeah, if you're born into that lifestyle and you know, it's really, you know, it's a hard one to imagine.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the adults who have been in the lifestyle, what do you think is the answer? I know in Vancouver, there a lot of people have been pushing for decriminalization versus abolition. And what do you see would be, beside obviously making sure that we have more treatment centers on demand, we've got cutting off the supply of the kids. What is the next chunk of the equation? What can we do with the women who are in the trade right now?
Well, I think we've got to give them some options. I mean, I really get tired, I guess, of women that are in the business, like inside, indoors, escorts or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, wanting to promote it and saying it's okay, you know, because they're comfortable doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I'm not happy with that. I'm not comfortable with it. You know, anybody I know or a friend or family member, you know, it's not okay to be a sex trade worker. Like, you were not brought into this, you know, this life to do that. Yeah, but you've got a group that are sort of comfortable doing it because of the money or the lifestyle or that's what they're used to. But I think if they had other options, they'd probably take it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the difficulty now is that the general public, I think, is starting to think that, you know, yeah, it is a choice. Well, you know what? It's not a choice. And if anybody thinks that legalization or decriminalization, you know, works, all you got to do is go in Frankfurt, you know, and look at some of the ads, you know, for, you know, the brothels are absolutely disgusting.
I was absolutely shocked when you showed me that and drew my attention to that in regards to the all-you-can-eat concept, where it's like you can go in and have sex with as many people as you want and
oh yeah,
and drink and do drugs, yep, and everything.
The ads portray them pretty much like you think that you're reading a, you know, sort of an ad for the sale of animals.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one I remember particularly was, you know, the picture of a girl and the caption said, "This girl pictured isn't necessarily the one you have to pick. We have better looking ones." Well, I find that really offensive.
Well, it is.
But you
very
know what?
Offensive.
If anybody out there thinks that legalization is the way to go, that's what you're looking at.
So, what is the difference between legalization and decriminalization?
Well,
I get confused about that sometimes.
It depends on who you talk to. Like nobody, I don't think anybody really knows because they're not sure what to do with it. So they talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And either one, like Nevada, it's legal. You know, Frankfurt is legal, but yet they've still got a couple of hundred girls working on the outstreets of Nevada and Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does nothing for the street population. Yeah, but when one of the problems that would happen, it would take it out of the police's hands. And right now, the police do have some control over it and try and track the girls. And in Frankfurt, when they legalized it, there was an influx of entrepreneurs, which you can call pimps,
mm-hmm.
you know, girls, all sorts of, you know, crime figures. Like, it just got out of control. You know, so it's a scary proposition. I mean, you know, legalization will do nothing, you know, for the women that are on the street that are HIV or Hep C or addicted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have to do is you have to look at proper treatment programs, help the women off the street. If you want to go after the Johns, the tricks and the guys that use these girls.
Mm-hmm.
I even seen an article where somebody was, you know, did some research and said that all Johns aren't bad. You know, and I just about fell off my chair. This guy portrayed him, this research, and he was from some university saying that they really weren't bad guys.
I'd say it would depend on the John, because there's different types. I wouldn't say that they're all great, but I do think there's obviously some social issues and things like that as to why, to the really, really, really severe ones. There's several different types, aren't there,
of sure,
Johns?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's bad dates, and there's, you know, guys that aren't bad dates, but, you know, the person is still basically, you know, paying, you know, a woman to have sex with somebody who says no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't care how you sort of, you know, whitewash that.
Well, it's about, would you say it's about power?
I'm not sure if it's power. I think, certainly the ones that, you know, come down to the downtown east side is probably about power, because down there they can pretty much do what they want.
Mm.
You know, and if they tried to go up the Seda High Track, which is, High Track is the one referred to up in Seymour where the girls are, you know, working up there.
Mm-hmm.
If you went up there, the bottom line is the girls up there would not do what the guys wanted. And the girls down the downtown east side do because of the crack addiction.
So what do you think comes first? Do you think the sex work because of the fact it's survival because of being on the street, especially if they start young? Or is it the addiction that comes first and they need to continue doing it?
Well, a lot of the women in the downtown east side, they, you know, the sex comes first because most of them are pretty badly abused.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the drugs come after to sort of mask the pain.
Okay.
But a lot of the women I deal with down there are literally born into it.
Wow.
You know, and that's all they've ever known.
So would the families get them into it as well? Like, I know you've said in terms of the sex, but in terms of the addiction, is that a way to control them?
It's not so much about control. It's just the families. That's all they've ever known.
Okay.
And when, like, so when I first came on the job, I really started, I was blaming the families, but then I found out the families were just as bad off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the mothers, you know, and I particularly remember this one, you know, young girl, she was 20 when she sort of turned her life around, but, you know, she was First Nations, came from a small reserve up north, and she said that until she was, like, 17 years old, she just thought, like, she was her sex.
Wow.
She said every male in her life, you know, abused her. You know, and it's a, that's a tough one. Yeah.
That is a tough one. In comparison to places like, say, Bountiful, B.C., where there's a lot of, well, in my mind, I'd consider that child exploitation. What are your thoughts in terms of that? Because those kids are born into that as well, even though they don't consider it a sex trade. But I do think when you're marrying a, you know, 12 or 13-year-old off to a 50-year-old man.
Yeah, there's something wrong with that.
Yeah.
You can sort of mask that with anything you want to call it, but, yeah. I'm appalled that we haven't done something about that. I mean, they've tried, but, you know, we mm-hmm. allow that to go on.
What do you think the answers are there, too, especially for again, in some ways it's similar because, again, it's generational. This is what they know, even though there isn't the addiction. There's, you know, and they couch that under religion, but at the same time it's two different communities in BC that they're born into it.
Yeah.
And what do you think the answer is if we're going to actually heal both, because I think in some ways it might be a little bit similar, because it's about breaking patterns.
Well, that's a tough one when you stand behind the religion thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they've taken a couple of runs at it, but I think they've failed. So, you know, like, what do you do with that, you know, other than ban it completely, you know, and go in and take all the children, you know, which I would probably do, but...
Well, it's not a bad thing, necessarily. It would be interesting.
Well, I mean, to marry a 14-year-old girl after a 50-year-old man, you know,
yeah,
but I mean, even our own government, I mean, the age of consent for a while was 14, yeah.
What is the age of consent these days?
I think they just raised it to 16, I think, yeah.
Okay.
But for a long time, it was 14, and you know, I don't know anybody out there who's got a 14-year-old daughter that's going to allow their daughter to go out and have sex with somebody that's, you know, a lot older, because I certainly wouldn't.
No, hopefully not.
No. No, I mean, at 14, you're just, I mean, you're, you know, you're just sort of maturing, but you're far from being able to make sort of right and conscious decisions about, you know,
mm-hmm.
people in older relationships, you know.
No, that's true. In regards to the Johns, what do you think the answer is? I know we've got John's school here, and I don't know too much about it. Would you be able to elaborate about that?
Well, the John's school is a bit of a joke. I think it, you know, the guy, if he gets arrested or caught with a sex trade worker, he has to go to school for a day and gets told that it's bad. You know, you know, and the girls used to get arrested and, you know, go to jail for it.
Wow,
that's a bit of a double standard.
That's a very double standard.
Yeah.
What do they do in other provinces?
Well, you know, they have the John School back east, and some, that's where we sort of picked up on it.
Mm.
You know, one of our counselors went back there and looked at it and thought it was a great idea. Yeah, but I mean, as far as I'm concerned, there was a case a couple of years ago where a guy was abusing, like badly abusing women and got charged. You know, and the prosecutor was going on the assumption, you know, he presented his case on the fact that you couldn't, you know, cause bodily harm to a girl. And I argued. I wanted him to go down and go to court with a psychiatrist saying that these girls, the only reason they did it was because of the addiction.
Yeah.
You know, they never would have consented to these violent acts these guys did. And some of them were quite violent.
Mm-hmm.
But he videotaped what he did. He showed himself paying the girl on camera. So the girls consented to everything. And some of the stuff was atrocious. But the prosecutor didn't want to, you know, go down that road, you know, to show that the girls were addicted and never would have done it if they weren't addicted, because he said if he was successful, he said that would mean anybody that came to the downtown east side and paid for sex would be guilty of a sexual assault. And I looked at him and I said, yeah, that's a good thing.
That's a really good thing.
Well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, yeah, if you come down and pay a woman, you know, for sex, that is a sexual assault. You know, because there's a certain imbalance of power. There's a criminal code section where, you know, if somebody's in a position of power, like a teacher, a counselor, a police officer, you know, and uses that power to, you know, to get, you know, sexual favors.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sexual assault. So there's really not that much difference with a, you know, John, regardless of how nice a guy he is, if he's coming down and preying on a woman that's addicted. You know.
Yeah. In terms of under the criminal, what is considered a sexual assault?
Well, it's just that, you know, there's a whole bunch of different sort of levels of sexual assault.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's usually violence involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like I say, there's, you know, there's a section where somebody's, you know, say challenged,
hmm.
you know, functioning at a low level. I think it's sex. It used to be called sex with the feeble-minded, which I think is a horrible phrase.
What did this? Could you repeat that?
Well, so it used to be, the term used to be sex with the feeble-minded.
That's what I thought you said.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which I always found really offensive. I thought,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to charge and drag this poor victim into court and tell her that she's feeble-minded, you know.
Wow.
You know, so that was a tough one. But I mean, there's different levels. I mean, there's assault with a weapon, sexual assault. There's, you know, so and none of them are, you know, are good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there's, you know, there's different sections, specific sections that people would be charged with. There's, if you come down and pay for the services of a sex trade worker that's under 18, that's a separate section.
Wow.
Yeah, but that's a tough one to prove because there was a, you know, a person charged with that, and of course he says, well, I didn't realize she was, you know, under 18. She told me she was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not supposed to be a defense, but it usually works.
Wow.
You know, so it's very difficult, you know.
No, that is.
And then, if you pray, like people come to the Downtown East Side, and the bad dates, you know, I'm talking about them, they come down there for a reason because most times they can get away with it. If they find a girl that's addicted or quite, you know, out there and quite high, there's no way she can usually testify in court.
Wow.
You know, so for most times you get away with it. And people know that.
Wow.
You know, because we do have sort of repeat predators that have been coming down there for years, you know, and getting away with it.
And so even after they've gone to John school, does it ever increase where they do get to go to jail?
I'm not sure what the recidivism rate is,
mm-hmm.
you know, like what their success rate is.
Wow.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to find out, like, how many people are repeat offenders.
It would be very interesting. I'll have to bug Bethany Tapp, one of our former board members for Beauty Night. She's actually been doing research for one of the professors at SFU for that in regards to John's.
But it's interesting because they've talked about for years about making lists of people that get charged with picking up sex trade workers, making the list public, you know, and because everything else is public, if you get charged with another offense,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can go in and find out the name of the person.
Wow.
You know, but if people are sexual assaults like that, you can't, for some reason.
Why do you think that is?
Well, just, I mean, there was a case in Abbotsford a few years back where there was actually a list of people,
mm-hmm.
you know, that were charged with a girl was running a bit of a ring, you know, and apparently there were some quite prominent people and they threatened to make the list public, and the police backed off because they got told very bluntly that, you know, there was a whole bunch of lawyers lined up.
Wow.
You know, so they sort of, you know, dumped it. You know, but I mean, they should be, you know, and publish the license plate numbers, publish the names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that may deter a lot of people. But right now, they can come out and they pretty much, you know, get away with it.
Wow. In terms of Shame the Johns campaigns, do you think pro or con?
I don't think there's a, you know, it's a bad thing.
Okay.
You know, I mean, you know, the civilian groups out there, you know, shaming the Johns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've never seen any sort of, some of them get carried away, so I mean, it depends on the people.
Because I was going to ask in regards to back in the 80s in terms of Davie Street, for example, like going back in history, like in terms of with shaming the Johns and things like that.
So that was a long time ago. I remember when the city actually passed a bylaw when the girls used to be on Davie
mm-hmm.
Street. You know, and they barred them from Davie Street, and they ended up on Seymour. You know,
wow.
So I mean, they could do that today, except now you've got a whole bunch of groups that sort of cry.
Oh, sorry, I didn't hear what you said, Dave.
What they did years ago in Davie Street was moved them all over to Seymour, and they've talked about doing that on the Downtown East Side. But every time they mention it, you know, certain groups, like no group wants all the girls moved into their area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you got a bunch of organizations that, you know, they don't know what to do with it.
Wow.
And I think that's why you hear people talking about legalization, or because they really don't know what to do with it.
Okay.
But I mean, there's so many women out there, they really can't put them all in brothels. And who's going to decide who gets to work in the brothels and who's left out on the street?
I guess it would have to do with the health and everything, too.
Yeah, I mean, the girls that are down on the Downtown East Side aren't going to fit into any sort of model. You know, they're out there in the street and they've got HIV and Hep C and a whole bunch of other, you know, host of issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, how is legalizing it going to make it any better? And people say, well, it's, you know, it's safer working indoors. Well, the last girl that was killed was indoors. You know, so there's really, it's a tough argument.
No,
I mean, I think all the organizations I work with down there, like yourself included, I think we all want the same thing. We all want to find a way to make it safer for the women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but sometimes we disagree on how to do it, but we all want the same thing. But, you know, I hate the analogy that, oh, it's been around forever. It's not going to go away, so let's just legalize it. I just hate that, you know.
No, because it's like, let's see what we can do in terms of a solution so we can make a difference and make people feel good so they don't have to and
well,
have
yeah,
other
I don't,
options.
You know, I'm not quite ready to throw my hands up and say, well, they're going to do it anyway, let's do it, because you know, I really get ticked with that sort of thinking.
And I love the fact that you're not at that stage, and, you know, because you've been doing this. Why are you a vagina warrior, Dave? Because
no,
you've been doing this for 30 years, seriously.
But I think, like, I'd love to be, you know, my best friend would be the Prime Minister or something like that. I'd ask him, how do we allow, you know, games like Grand Theft Auto where, you know, people get out there and bash hookers, you know, sex trade workers with a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Grand Theft Auto, we've got nightclubs having pimp and hoe night. We got school kids in school. It's a big thing to call, you know, the other girls bitches and hoes in school. So I think the men out there have to sort of, you know, stand up and be counted and start saying enough's enough.
And the women do too, because sometimes girls are just as cruel to each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think it's a societal thing where we just started to accept things. You know, so I can see them having a career day in school soon, but, you know, sex trade worker, you know. Yeah, and as stupid as that sounds,
mm-hmm.
you know, I see us going towards there more and more.
Yeah.
You know, with the talk about legalization and throwing terms like that out where nobody gets offensive anymore.
Wow.
When my daughter told me a couple of years back that that's what they were calling the other girls, all the boys in school were doing it, and not just her school. I checked with other schools. Mm-hmm. They called all the girls bitches and hoes. And I told her, I said, if anybody calls you that, I'll tell you right where to kick them. I said, you just don't, you can't stand, you know, or let that go.
Mm-hmm. No, it's important. It's good that she's got a dad like you. So that, well,
she turned out okay.
She turned out okay, which is a really good thing. One of the things you brought up was bad dates. And I have this feeling, and even though I know the answer to this one, I'd love to hear it in your words, because I have this feeling bad dates in some of the survival sex workers' lives is not exactly what some of my girlfriends would consider a bad date.
What do you mean, sorry?
I'm just being facetious. In terms of a bad date, what exactly is a bad date in the land of sex work?
Well, somebody that comes down and basically, you know, tames sex and then beats the girl up and takes the money back.
Okay.
You know, in the simplest terms. Or you know, does even if he pays her for the date, but if he's violent with her,
mm-hmm.
like the guy I was talking about a little while back, even though he, you know, the girls consented to do it and he paid them,
mm-hmm.
as far as I was concerned, he's still a bad date because he was still very violent.
Yeah.
The fact that they consented means nothing because it was just the only reason they consented. And all five girls that I got into court, all five girls said the same thing. I asked them specifically, would you have done this if you weren't addicted? And they all looked at me and said, of course not.
Hmm.
Yeah, but that was just for my own sort of interest. And, you know, and so it's guys like that drive around and they're very good at picking out, you know, the girls that are hurting,
mm-hmm.
you know, and very desperate for the next rock cocaine.
In terms of with the Olympics coming, and I guess it's opening up tomorrow, so it's coming very, very fast and furious. I've noticed even volunteering in the downtown east side. I've been propositioned more and more lately than I ever have been. And I have this feeling it's going to increase. What are your thoughts in terms of that, just in terms of just women just coming down there?
Well, certainly, I'm not sure if there's going to be a lot more women coming down,
mm-hmm.
you know, to the streets. I mean, I'm expecting more, like, you know, sex trade workers in the escort industry and mm-hmm. massage and indoor workers.
Yeah.
You know, but you're going to get a lot more people in town, so you are going to see increased traffic in the downtown side.
Okay.
And then you got to remember, I mean, you got 10,000 extra security alone, police, Navy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to be out there, too, in the nightclubs and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was with the police for a long time, so I know that they like to have a drink, too.
I think many of us do.
Yeah.
So,
you know, so it's just there's going to be a lot more people in town, and I think you're going to see an impact everywhere, you
mm-hmm.
know, on all levels. I mean, people may not know, but I think 85% of the sex trade is indoors, you know, the last sort of, you know, statistic I heard. So only 15% of it is actually outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot. I mean, just you just have to look at the Georgia Strait and the papers to see the ads and the classified for, you know, indoor workers. It's amazing.
No, it's true. There's a lot of them. I was just wondering in terms of just thinking back to, I believe it was Sweden, where they've adopted an abolition model. And it, apparently a lot of the countries around them that have said yes in terms of decriminalization. There's been an increase in terms of organized crime. And I'm just thinking in terms of just say, hypothetically, we were in a decriminalized state right now, and obviously that depends on things. Do you think there would be an increase in organized crime?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, the money is incredible. Yeah. I mean, if you're a pimp,
mm-hmm.
if you find a young girl, let's say, I mean, you're looking at $1,000 a night.
Really?
Yeah.
Even
easily.
Wow.
You know, easily $1,000 a night, you know, for somebody that's a girl that's not on drugs and you know, 18 years old, and you know, the money's incredible. So I mean, you're going to have a ton of people trying to cash in on that.
Wow.
And for all intents and purposes, like, it's really misleading because it really is, you know, already legalized. I mean, if you want to work out of your own house, you know, I don't think you're ever going to get busted.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, you're just taking one guy. If you want to get greedy and start opening up a brothel and running, then you're probably going to be looked at.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you want to be a sex trade worker and you know, bring guys back to your own house, you know, the chances are you know, you'll never get arrested.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to see an increase in more women coming here if we did end up decriminalizing? Because that was one of the things I was worried about was A, organized crime, and B, the other concern, obviously, was about the women. And also, are we going to have women in from other countries where, because it's under a labor law, where it's more difficult to find things?
Oh, for sure. When Frankfurt legalized it, they have people from all over Europe, you know, coming in. I mean, we already get people here just because of our weather.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's
BC
true.
Is warmer and milder. I mean, if you want to work the streets in, you know, Saskatoon or something like that in 40 below, so, I mean, we already have, you know, women that come out here from back east, you know, every year, you know, in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if they legalize it, you can bet there'd be an influx of women.
Wow.
And not just women. We keep focusing on women, but, I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of the male sex trade workers, too. You know, I mean, certainly the majority of women, but, you know, a number of reasons, you know, lead them out to BC. For a long time, years ago, it used to be because of the easier welfare.
Hmm.
You know, it was easier to collect welfare and get on welfare out here, but that's been tightened up now. But we still people coming, you know, see people coming out because of the weather, you know, a whole bunch of reasons. But if they legalize it, there'd be a train on its way.
Wow. In terms of male, tell me a little bit more about male sex workers.
Well, you've got, you know, I mean, you've got certain areas, you know, downtown Yale Town.
Mm-hmm.
You got transgender, and you got all sorts of types, you know, that are out there working. And same, you know, really the same sort of background. You know, a lot of abuse. You know, they're out there for similar reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes they get overlooked. I mean, there's some really good organizations that have outreach workers that are dealing, you know, trying to reach the male sex trade workers now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they're sort of in the same, you know, pot.
And what do you think? Do you think it's different answers for the guys, or is it similar?
I think it's similar. I think the answers are the same. I mean, people, you know, we have to have some place where they're ready, you know, to do, you know, something with their lives, and then we have to have some place to drive them. I mean, it's got to be, you know, like on demand.
Mm-hmm.
We can't make a few phone calls and come back and tell them there's no beds. Do you want to come back again and try again tomorrow?
Yeah.
You know, like other places don't have that. Like Sweden, they have a mandatory program, the same as Italy. If you get caught working the streets or dealing drugs, you know, you get arrested and you don't go to jail. You get sent to a treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
And in some places, it's a minimum one-year program to 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's effective. I mean, they, you know, they get in there, they get off the drugs, they, you know, they get treatment or counseling for whatever their needs are. Cause it's not just simple as getting them off the drugs. Now you have to find out why they're out there in the first place. And then if you can fix that, then you've got a real good kick at the can.
No, that makes sense, because a few weeks ago, I actually had... I had a guest on actually from one of the eating disorder clinics, and she had actually described eating disorder, and it made me think about drug addiction actually, where she described it as it was just a coping mechanism, and you had to get actually to the root of everything figuring out how to recognize those triggers, which prompt the overeating and the binging, which again I figure is similar to drugs and alcohol, and B, actually trying to figure out how to deal with it and create it, finding another way that to deal with that in a healthy way. Because at one point, drugs, alcohol, you know, overeating, whatever, it's basically, it suppresses a lot of the emotion.
No, you can argue probably 98% of the people that are out there have an underlying problem. I mean, the drugs are just sort of a symptom of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to really, once you get them off the drugs, now they're getting healthy, you know, and now you have to sort of look at why they're out there and fix that. And sometimes that may take as long as a year for starters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, you know, after that, another 3 or 4 years of follow-up.
Wow.
You know, so it does take a long time, but it's, you know, like, see, when you look at the years of abuse, you know, that's why I tell the women that I work with, I mean, you're 19 years old now, and so you've been, you know, putting up with this for 19 years. You're not going to undo this in 2 or 3 years.
Wow. The last study I read said the average age of entry was 12 into street life, which I don't know if those stats would still hold true in BC, and then they said 14 across the country.
It was, yeah, you know, the last I heard was 14.
Okay.
But see, that's the ones that we sort of know of. I mean, you know, so the, you know, when you go into homes, you know, and find younger kids and you know something's going on, and these kids are like 9 and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a real tough one, yeah.
Okay.
I think it's probably lower. And you have to sort of separate them, too, because, I mean, that's the average age into it. But when you get families that are sort of, they live that,
mm-hmm.
you know, the kids are literally born into it.
So I guess the big question is, you said cutting off the supply of the kids. So A, if we can educate the teachers, even though they do recognize things, and with social services, I guess, just educating the general public as to call and how to recognize when there is abuse.
Well, for sure. I mean, yeah, if I could wave my magic wand, mm. you know, and be standing in the doors of the school when the kids come into, you know, well, even before that, I mean, kindergarten even. I mean, I can recognize a kid because I used to go into the local kindergartens in my area all the time in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I could tell the kids, you know, that were sort of, it's like, you know, a certain, I won't mention the mall, but a certain mall in Burnaby, you can go in there. And it's basically a hangout for kids and young pimps.
Wow.
And I've watched it. I've done it myself. I watched a table full of young girls, and I can pick out the girl that's most vulnerable. You know, because it'd be four or five girls that all be joining a conversation, except one girl would be hanging back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I'm good at what I do, I'm going to focus in on that girl, you know, and she'll be my friend, you know, within an hour. You know, and this is what pimps do. And some of the pimps I'm talking about are 15, 16 years old.
How does somebody become a pimp at 15 or 16 years old?
Well, they get recruited by other, you know, older people.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, it's really tough for, you know, say a 22-year-old to get onto school grounds or do different things. So what they do is they grab the younger kids and sort of bring them into the gangs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they used to go into the malls and into the school grounds. And, you know, so there is, you know, praying, you know, like that going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier for them to do that. But if the kid's good at it, he can pick the kid out.
Wow.
You know, so I mean, you know, you can pick the one girl that's sort of vulnerable and hanging back, and that her self-esteem is low, and so you just start talking to her and chat her up, and make the next thing you know, you got a friend, and it's really as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And I know one of our clients, I won't mention her name, who has her own organization now, but she'd mentioned she was actually recruited by other females when she was recruited originally. Do you see that often?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, there are other girls that pray, and even some more horrendous cases where girls will pick up other girls for bad dates. Because
really?
What it does is that now it takes that girl, she doesn't have to do, you know, any violent sort of acts herself. If she can find a substitute, you know, now she's basically preying on other women.
Wow.
But it sort of lets her off the hook, and she doesn't have to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, yeah, that's sort of a tough one because you blame her, but then you look at her, you know, realistically for her, you know, she doesn't have to get beat up and you know, a whole bunch of other stuff anymore if she can find somebody to take her place.
Wow.
And it's not that they don't care about other people, but they get to that low point in their life,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the addiction and self-esteem and a whole bunch of other stuff sort of, you know, clicks in where they just don't care about, you know, it's just a survival thing.
Mm-hmm. With the really young pimps, is that gang related usually?
Some of them, you know, because, you know, a lot of the young guys aren't, you know, they don't know, you know, enough to do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a few kids that are like that, and, you know, but most times, you know, they get sort of drawn into the gangs. And when I say gangs, I mean, there's so many gangs out there, and some of them are, you know, 15 years old, you know, 15, 16, 18.
Wow. I keep forgetting about that, but I do remember that from high school, back when.
Yeah. Well, you've got so many, you know, you've got the Asian gangs, you've got the, you know, the historical gangs. I mean, there's so many gangs
the
up
Hondurans.
There. And there's, I mean, there's enough money for all of them, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the downtown side, you're looking at probably, in illicit drugs, I mean, you're probably looking at $250 million a year.
Do you think that's
hands.
One of the reasons that that they haven't cracked down on it, because there's too much money there?
Well, I think there's, you know, just far too many drugs.
Okay.
I mean, they make arrests all the time, but it's just there's so much coming in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you read about a big shipment, you know, a couple of hundred pounds getting caught, I mean, there's a replacement shipment on its way already the next day.
Wow.
You know, so there's just, you know, they just can't stem the, you know, and us being a port city, there's so many different ways to get it in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's never been, the 29 years I've been around, I've never seen a shortage where it's dried right up.
What are some of the unusual drugs that are out there right now that people should just be really aware of?
Well, the crystal, even the marijuana now is has changed so much. You can take every medical report about, you know, ever being done about marijuana and throw it out the window, basically.
Really?
Oh, for sure. The stuff they have now is laced with crystal meth. You know, I mean, because you have to remember, it's a billion-dollar industry,
mm-hmm.
and the guys that are manufacturing, like the grow-ups, you know, when I say grow-ups, I mean hundreds and hundreds or thousands of grow-ups, you know, they want their stuff to be the best, so they're actually adding, you know, chemicals to it and crystal meth in some cases to make it more addictive and make it stronger.
Wow.
You know, because they want the customers coming back to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people talk about legalization. It's really quite laughable. You know, I mean, the government can legalize it and they can make all the marijuana they want, but do you think for a second, you know, that if I'm, you know, selling my good stuff, that I'm going to lose any business? So, It's silly, because if you legalize it now, you got red tape from, you got Health Canada, you got all sorts of people involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they can only make it a certain strength. Well, I don't have to worry about, you know, do I really care if I'm, you know, frying somebody's brain?
Hmm.
You know, so legalization's a joke with marijuana.
Wow.
I got the best stuff in the world. People are going to come back to me and buy mine.
That's really scary.
Well, as simple as that, yeah. But I've had people downtown that smoke marijuana for years, and all of a sudden they're complaining about being paranoid and then hallucinating and all sorts of stuff.
That makes sense. I remember hearing about that a couple of years ago from, I think the group was called From Grief to Action.
The lawyer.
And I remember just being absolutely surprised about that. I was like, wow, that's wild. But
on the downtown east side, we don't see, you know, the norm down there is still a little bit of heroin, you know, cocaine and the crack cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't see a lot of crystal meth, don't see a lot of marijuana. You know, the people there are pretty entrenched in their, you know, their old-style drugs.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why wouldn't they mix it with meth to make it stronger? Or would it just be a really bad chemical compound?
It's a pretty bad chemical, you know, mix.
Okay.
You know, so they, you know, they like what the crack cocaine does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, you know, I think the last estimate I heard was 75% of the drug use down there is now is the smoke in the pipe.
Hmm.
You know, which is quite, you know, funny, because when you look at the safe injection site, you know, only 25% of the people actually inject.
Wow. Which I guess is why there's more programs now, like the crack kits and things like that, in terms of getting the pipes.
Yeah, I mean, the harm reduction, I'm not,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not that big into that. I mean, methadone, I mean, if you go back to the inception of harm reduction, that was a methadone program that came out 20-something years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And methadone is more addictive and more harmful to your body.
Wow.
You know, we were talking to some nurses the other day, and there's the big problem downtown is all the bad teeth. People have their teeth falling out. And in a lot of cases, that's methadone.
Wow.
You know, and one guy by the name of Billy, he runs some houses out, recovery houses out in Coquitlam, and he just laughed. We were at a convention of about 500 people, and he said, you know what? He says, you come down here to the downtown east side, and he says, people are trying to get off drugs, and he says, and you put them on methadone. He says, what the hell is that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's really, in its inception, when it was first brought in, when they made everybody do urine tests, you know, and cut down the doses, when it was really heavily monitored, it was probably effective.
Mm-hmm.
But now all those rules that originally came in with methadone have gone out the window. You know, you can stand outside a methadone clinic, which there is numerous clinics on the downtown side now because it's mm-hmm. a huge moneymaker. You can stand outside a clinic and watch somebody coming out with their prescription and trading it 10 feet from the door for a rock cocaine.
Wow.
You know, that's how well it's monitored.
That's wild.
Yeah. You know, so the methadone programs. In the corner of Pigeon Park, you can literally see 5 methadone clinics from that one corner. And they hand out muffins, they hand out coffees, they have microwaves so the drug users can heat up their pizzas. And according to the College of Pharmacists, they're not supposed to do that.
Really?
Yeah. No stipends, I think. The rules read, you know, like no muffins, no coffee, no. You know, I mean, they even give commission. If you're a drug user and you bring a friend in, you can get anywhere from $10 to $20 cash in your pocket from the, you know, the pharmacies.
Which, if you're dealing with addiction issues, but even just living in poverty, it'd be pretty cool, actually. That's a good referral system, actually.
Money in my pocket, yeah.
Yeah, actually, that's better than a lot of referral systems out there, to be honest.
No, people don't, you know, really understand that, you know, how bad the addiction, the downtown side is quite different because it's extreme, extreme, extreme.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, one person didn't believe me when I told them that people are actually trying to contact HIV, you know, so they can get on welfare and disability too, because they get an extra $400 a month.
Mm-hmm. That shocked me when you told me that at the beginning.
Yeah. Because you have to realize if it's an extra $400 in their pocket,
mm-hmm.
do they really care if they have HIV?
No, because if they're in that state of depression.
No, you know, and they see they have their friends, and their friends have got HIV, and they're still fixing with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to them, it's not a real fear. Yeah, but the reality is they got an extra $400 in their pocket.
That's true. And with HIV these days, I know when I had a show on Pride, we actually talked about that, just that they're having to re-educate a lot of the youth because they, with HIV, they're like, oh, well, there's a drug cocktail, so it's fine.
Yeah.
And they don't see it as people dying anymore because it's controllable.
No, that's right. It's like a cold and getting a bad cold and progressing to pneumonia. That doesn't happen that often.
No.
I think that's how the people look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may get HIV, but I'll never get full-blown AIDS.
Wow.
You know, so give me the money.
That's a very scary thought.
Well, it really is, yeah. And because how do all these prevention programs around the spread of HIV and everything else, how do you, you know, justify them if people are running around or they're trying to catch it?
What about hepatitis C in terms of, you said only 25% are usually using needles, but in regards to hep C, have you seen a lot of a more increase or about the same?
I think it's about the same, but I'm not sure. You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to sort of look at the nurses, you know,
stats.
You know, for that.
Okay.
I mean, it's fairly prevalent down there.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I know when I do volunteer orientation, that's the one I'm actually more concerned with a lot of the times, just because that virus lives outside the human body a lot longer.
Yeah.
And you never know, and especially even little things like wherever there's a shower program somewhere, because sometimes the women do share razors and it's actually really transferable.
Yeah.
Even through just like basic toiletries.
No, I know it's a sort of an unfortunate reality that, you know, they don't, you know, put their health care, you know, right up there, very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's sad.
But it comes down to survival again, so.
Yeah. We've tried over the years, you know, when I used to go to the Wish Drop-In, you know, which was a weekly basis about educating the women about going out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we gave them pencils and pads and, you know, taught them all sorts of things. But the, you know, the bottom line was when they went out there, they went out there by themselves and, you know, without a spotter and, you know, took a chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so until we can sort of, like, it's no better now. I mean, with the Picton thing, you know, almost over now, you know, it's no better now because if somebody had a farm up in Hope and started coming down next week, they can pick up girls